Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Buenas noches. Feliz Cinco de Mayo to everybody. Cinco de Mayo, you know, not really a holiday, but it's fun to celebrate anything for any reason. So I'm going to say that we should celebrate. Did you watch the Kentucky Derby? No, you didn't. It's 2 minutes of your life that you didn't waste, I guess. But, you know, the Kentucky Derby is such an interesting cultural thing. I'm a big traveler, and I love a good road trip. And I want to tell you that if you're looking for a road trip this summer, Louisville, Kentucky is a really neat town. I don't know how many hours does it take? 4 or 5 hours to get there. And, you know, it's just a great town. It's sort of the South, but it's sort of the Midwest. And even if you don't have anything to do with horse racing, and you've never been to the horse track, you've never been to Arlington or Sportsman's, it's just an interesting cultural thing. And if you go there, I would definitely take the short tour of Churchill Downs. It's a beautiful place. I believe it's designed by the same people who designed our Arlington Park. And it's just a beautiful place. And it's a fascinating story of the culture of horse racing, which, you know, back in the day and in, you know, even the turn of the century, used to be one of the biggest sports ever. People would come by the thousands and thousands to see horse racing. And it was a cultural thing. It was a sporting event. It was a sign of affluence. It was just a very interesting tour. But what was interesting about, I made a bet with my husband, so there was no money involved. But I said, I always pick a horse that has to do with something about the law. So I think Justify, I picked last year because it had something to do with the law. And I picked Maximum Security this year. And of course, the Maximum Security crossed the line first, but they took away the title because of horse interference. I mean, who knew there was such a thing? And I always like to go to the rules, because if anyone is interested out there, I'm not going to spend much time on it. The rules say if a leading horse or other horse in a race swerves or is ridden to either side so as to interfere with or impede the other horse or jockey, the action shall be deemed a foul. And if, in the opinion of the stewards, a foul alters the finish of the race, so it has to not only be interference, but it has to alter the finish, the offending horse may be disqualified by the stewards. And the steward in this case determined that the horse moved into the line of two horses and impacted two horses, and that but for that impact, the other two horses could have had a shot. And so poor old Maximum Security was disqualified. It is what it is, but hope you enjoyed it if you watched it. We have a guest coming up, and we're going to be talking about the A.J. Friend case. Not really so much about the case, but more about the DCFS and how it works. I'd like to give everyone an education on how the process works so you can see that it's not a perfect process and that that there are certain things in place that are there to guarantee rights of parents but also guarantee rights of children, and that they're not always the one who's going to catch these horrible things that happen in our system. And we'll be talking to an expert in that area. But I want to talk in the next few minutes about school and free speech. We've had several cases that have come down, one, I think, last week, and then one couple weeks before. The one this week was a Homewood Flossmoor case where students staged a walkout after pictures of students, white students with blackface, appeared on social media. My understanding is the students themselves didn't post it, but someone took a picture and posted it on social media. There was a prior incident in Mount Carmel with some racial issues. And then this week in a little town in Ohio, in Belleville, Ohio, there was a kid, and maybe you saw it. I'm going to read the sign. The sign said he's picking up his kid, his date for prom, and he made a sign that was colorful, and he obviously spent some time on it. It said, "If I was black, I'd be picking cotton, but I'm white, so I'm picking you up for prom." That, of course, went viral, went crazy, and people were threatening the life of the family and the child. Child issued an apology, said he was just kidding around. But I guess I want to talk a little bit about what should happen when a student does something outside the classroom walls. Okay, you're at home, you're somewhere else, you're not on school property, and you're posting something that is offensive. Okay, pretty clear that these are offensive things that are happening. But does First Amendment extend all the way to when you're not at school? Give us a call, and I'm going to give you a little education on the law of this, but I want to hear from you. 981-7200. What do you think? Do you think students should be able to do offensive things, make mistakes, take the punishment for it, but not be expelled from school, not have the school make determinations as to what is and what isn't appropriate when you're out of the school? So first, 981-7200, a text to that number. The first distinguishing point we have to make is between public and private schools. Private schools are not regulated by the First Amendment. Why? Because the First Amendment says that the government shall take no action to abridge freedom of speech, which means the government has to be involved. So if you have a private school like St. Ignatius, St. Ignatius can, if it wants, to have a moral code. And that moral code can extend to summer vacation, to weekends, to after school. You can't use racial things. You have to say things that are consistent with the Catholic faith. Whatever those things you can't say or do anything to bring the school into disrepute. Those types of wording and that type of language, that's in apprentice kind of standard in some Catholic school handbooks. And the school can punish you for things that you do outside of the school. That's pretty clear. But when you have a public school like Homewood Flossmoor, that is government. The school is equal signs the government. So you can't abridge someone's First Amendment speech. The Supreme Court has ruled, you know, has weighed in on some of this, but not very often. Basically, the Supreme Court has said that if you do something inside the classroom and inside the school that disrupts the school, clearly this is something that the school can regulate. So if you badmouth a teacher, if you're wearing something suggestive, if you're there was one case where a kid posted a sign that advocated the use of drugs at a school assembly, that was clearly something that the child could be punished for because you're trying to teach kids morals and values in school other than reading, writing, and arithmetic. You are able as a teacher and as a school to say, no, that's wrong. You can't do that. That's offensive. We're going to discipline you in some way. When the action is outside the school, the Supreme Court says it can't be regulated unless it disrupts the school inside the school or it affects and impacts the rights of students inside the school. So the example I give is, let's just say a girl wore a half top to school and the teachers said, you know, we don't allow kids to wear half tops or tank tops or something because we have a dress code. Surely the school can say you have to go home and change or reprimand the child. Let's just say that same girl posted a picture of herself on Facebook with a half top on at the beach somewhere. In my view, probably the courts would agree with me that the Supreme Court's ruling that said, you know, you can't, and First Amendment extends to freedom of expression too, so her posting that picture is, even though it's not speech, it's expression, that wouldn't be a disruption in the classroom, because how can you say the disruption that happened maybe outside the classroom impacted the students in the classroom? That probably would be a case of First Amendment. But when you have kids that are posting racially driven messages outside in social media, which now social media is a little different than what people say and think and do back in our day. Now it's posted and it goes viral. It does impact in some ways what happens in school. For instance, the Homewood Flossmoor kids staged that walkout, and that was disruptive to the school. But I'd like to hear from you. How the law is what it is, and the law will develop in this area, but I'd like to know, how are you talking to your kids about these issues? Are you talking to your kids about how to stay off social media with these kinds of offensive things? Because it will turn your life around. I know families that have considered moving out of state because of the hate mail that they've gotten for these silly posts that are really offensive, but, you know, a kid does it and you should learn from it, but instead they're going to now be punished by being expelled and having their families' lives threatened. 981-7200. Give me your opinion. 981-7200. This is The Karen Conti Show.
Excuse me. First Amendment. Son, the First Amendment protects you from the government. not for me. You can say whatever you want to out there. You come within reach of me, I'll exercise my right to give you a good old country whooping.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I just love that. What we're talking about is the First Amendment when it deals with students. Yeah, students can have First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court has said that. But they're tempered by the idea that teachers are there to be formative and help students become better people. So, yeah, they can regulate some of the speech if it's offensive or disruptive in the school. But what happens when the student is making those statements or posting pictures, which is expression of speech, or it's freedom of expression, not necessarily speech. It's the same thing. What happens when you're posting stuff on your summer break? What, you know, your kids are going to be home for 3 months. What are you going to do? They're posting stuff all over the place. What if they post something that's so offensive that people start complaining about it and try to get your kid expelled? Is that fair? Is that something that you have talked to your kids about? Is that something that's a reality? What do you think the schools should do? Should they punish the kids, or are the kids punished enough by making offensive comments? Give us a call. I would like to hear your opinions. 312-981-7200. Robert from Chicago has a comment. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, I don't believe we're even talking about something like this. I look at both sides of this, and it's the parents that are the problem. They just haven't trained their kids properly. A private school, they can do whatever they want. They can get you at 12 o'clock at night if you're out.
That's true. Right.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want. Public school, they have no standing unless something is posted during school hours. They have no standing. I mean, you could have a kid that belongs to Farrakhan and another kid who belongs to the all-white right. You can't touch it. And you know what? And if they did, the kid could sue the parents if they were smart. But they're probably not smart parents for raising kids like that.
Well, let me just interject, because the Supreme Court has said that if a student does something outside of school that disrupts the class inside of school, then yes, the school can discipline that child and can do something to impact that child. So the law says otherwise. I understand what you're saying.
No. I totally understand. And I wasn't privy to that. I did not know that the Supreme Court went that far left. And when did they do this? When was this when is this law going into effect?
You know, I don't know, Robert. I want to say it was about 15 or 20 years ago. It wasn't recent. And I think it was before the age of social media. So it was something, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something that there was a disruption to the classroom.
Yeah.
And therefore, they said that it reached, because the school has a higher obligation than a government agency. So like, let's just say that you're working for a government agency, and the government agency says, no, when you're at home, you can't post stuff about Trump. Well, that's First Amendment. Clearly, First Amendment, that would be blown out of the water. The government agency would be deemed to be doing something unconstitutional. But because these students are still formative and you don't want to disrupt the other students. So, for instance, and you give me your read on this, students have posted kind of mockeries of the teachers on Facebook. What do you think the school should be able to do in that one?
When was this done? Is this a private school?
No, this is a public. It's a public school.
You know, if it's done after hours, that's just, you know, if I was a school, I'd talk to the parents.
Right. But then,
I would talk to the parents. I would go private and talk to the parents and make sure it doesn't happen again. Because you could have a student, you know, lash out at a teacher for whatever. And typically what they do is they call the parents in, call the teacher in, they have a talk, and they get it resolved.
Now, in that case, the court said it was okay because the students were just, you know, making fun, and they were posting their opinions about their teachers, and there was nothing disruptive about it. Flash to another case where students got together and talked about various girls in the class and what their bodies looked like and who had, you know, who was not attractive, and kind of said mean things about the students. And it hurt the girls' feelings. They were very upset. They felt bullied. They didn't want to come to class. And there the court said, yeah, you do. This was disrupting the class. And the school does have a right to abridge that freedom of speech.
Oh, I'm sure they do that. And what you're really telling me is, the way I surmise this, is that the teachers have no control. They don't know what they're doing to let it get that far. should never have gotten that far if they're teachers and they're going to teach.
Well, I don't think teachers control what these kids do outside on social media. Do you?
Well, no, I understand. But the social media, I think that's got to be revisited. I mean, because, you know, I think the Supreme Court's got to go back and really revisit it. Times have changed from 20 years ago.
You're right. Robert, thank you so much. You know, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. Take care. I just want to read one more thing. You are a representation of your school. Cause and effect. New technology brings new ways to deal with actions. Of course, will kids say and do foolish things, although it's insensitive to another culture. And goes on to say that. Have a great night. Yes, supposedly Helmut Flossmer has a mandatory sensitivity course, you know, and I think these schools probably all have such a course. Good point. Thank you so much. Let's take a break now. And when we come back after the news, we're going to be talking about the issue of the DCFS and what can they do? What can't they do? What are their procedures? Why did this fail in the little case of the little boy out in Crystal Lake? This is a Karen Conti show, and this is WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti show. I'll be taking your calls at 8 o'clock on any legal topic you might have or a current event that you saw you'd like to discuss. I'm always available to try to give you an answer or steer you in the right direction and in the process maybe educate other people as well, whether it's family law, traffic ticket, will or trust, contract. I'll try my best to answer your questions. And why don't you put this number in? We're not going to go to it right now. 981-7200-312-981-7200 or text. And if you would like to talk to me at the office, sometimes you have something that might be a little more private or a little more involved, you can always call me at my office, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me and I can try to send an answer back to you right away or try to get you some help in any way I can, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Well, everyone's talking about this horrible case of poor A.J. Frond, is the 5-year-old boy who disappeared from his parents' home in Crystal Lake on April 18th, as the parents reported. Across the country, I think we were all concerned. We had hope. And then there was sadness and finally anger as it was discovered that the boy was allegedly killed by his parents after being beaten and tortured and buried in a field in a shallow grave. An autopsy found the boy had died from blunt force trauma to his head. The parents are charged with the murder of their son. The DCFS had dealt with this family for many years, ever since AJ was born with opiates in his system. And there were many times where they had gotten involved, and the police apparently were called, from what I read, 17 times to the house during his short life. You know, many people are critical of the DCFS here. We're looking to blame people, and that's what we do, and maybe we have a right to do that. But I want to get the facts here. Why didn't this organization do something more to intervene? Or could they not do it? Did their own laws and their own organization prevent them from getting this family the help it needed? We're very fortunate tonight. We have Kent Dean, who is an attorney who practices in these cases. He's gets involved in the investigation and the appeals of these cases, and he knows about the tools that the DCF has and why the system sometimes fails. He's been doing it for 20 years. He received the Honored Family Defender of the Year Award, and I welcome him to the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Kent. How are you?
Good evening. Thanks for having me. Appreciate the chance to explain a little bit about this, how the department does these investigations.
Great. I really want to hear about it. Now, can you just explain from kind of start to finish how claims generally get made, how these complaints get made, generally, typically speaking, and kind of walk it through the typical case?
Well, what typically happens is a hotline call is made. Somebody such as quite often a mandated reporter, such as a school teacher or a pediatrician or a school counselor, somebody hears something that the child says that causes some alarm, or they see a bruise on a child, especially a child that isn't verbal. Bruises on a child that's not verbal yet at daycare or school will get some attention. Not verbal, I should say, not verbal. Maybe he's not clear, doesn't explain real well how do you get the little bruise, and that's a good source of a lot of my cases. What happens is once the hotline call is made, then somebody in Springfield takes that call and they categorize it either as a case that they're going to take or a case they're going to take down as simply information, and then they pass it on to an investigator if in fact they're going to take this as a call. And there are some criteria as to what makes it an actual call as opposed to They're just going to take it as information. And basically, is if there's something contained in there that, if in fact true, would in fact constitute abuse or neglect to the child or risk of abuse or neglect to the child.
Okay.
And typically within 24 hours, somebody responds.
Okay. And so someone responds. And what generally do they do? Do they talk to the child if the child's verbal? Do they talk to both parents? Do they seek out witnesses? Or how extensive is their investigation in these cases?
The initial mandate report, or the mandate means they're supposed to make a response within 24 hours. Initial mandate is supposed to at least lay eyes on the child and hopefully at least make some contact with the person who made that call. If the child is still in an emergency room when the hotline call goes in, typically DCFS investigator will be there before they leave the emergency room within hours. If it's a less pressing matter, you know, quite certainly within 24 hours, and laying eyes on the child, try to talk to the child if at all possible. They do show up at school to talk to the child quite often before they've even told the parents there's an investigation going on,
and
which definitely makes people jump.
Sure. And, you know, again, like when they come to their conclusions, how do they reach their conclusion? I mean, that's kind of an open-ended question, is how does anyone reach a conclusion about what really happened? What is the criteria?
They investigate. If it's a medical case, obviously they compile medical records. They get opinions from whoever treated the child. If they have some confused or they think that they're not satisfied with the clarity of the medical diagnosis they have, they will run it by some doctors that they utilize quite a bit. They will talk to any potential witnesses that the police were involved, especially if the police are the ones that called it in. They will certainly talk to the officers who made that initial call. Nonverbal children present certain challenges, obviously. That's the case, you have to look at circumstantial evidence. And again, with nonverbal children, there's often the issue is medical evidence with nonverbal children. So it's really analysis of you know, what do we have here in terms of the images and the interpretation and what have you.
I take it that the investigators are trained in talking to children, because I would imagine that you have to be very gentle and very careful when you question a child about his parent, because, you know, children don't necessarily trust adults who they don't know. To your knowledge, are they pretty good at doing that?
I think to a great degree. I mean, they're all supposed to have at least a bachelor's degree in a related field. There have been a lot of new hires recently. I'm encountering them here and there, and most of them seem to be on the ball and trying to do their best with what they can. With the more complicated, especially like sexual abuse allegations, the investigator who actually initially responds is usually directed not to get in much of a conversation with the child about the allegation itself. They save that for later for what is called a victim-sensitive interview, which is typically conducted with the child psychologist in a rather controlled manner. And there they try to divine, you know, what is the child's perception of what happened here.
I suppose
much more formal setting.
And I suppose they don't want to plant information in a child's mind, and that could be used, you know, by one way or the other. Right.
Yeah, now, and I found that they're pretty good about that. They respect that, and they'll ask the basic, you know, do you feel safe at home? Do you feel safe here? Is anyone in the house giving you a hard time? And then they'll often leave it at that. It's like, listen, you know, we're going to come back here in a little while, and someone else is going to ask you more specific questions. And they leave it at that.
So let's just take a case, and we're not talking about the Fran case. We're talking about just a general case. What if we have a family that, you know, believes in corporal punishment, and the dad and the mom both spank their child, and, you know, and they spank their child pretty hard? What?
Corporal punishment per se, spanking per se is not prohibited in Illinois. In some states it may be, but in Illinois it's not per se illegal to spank your child in the traditional sense, like we all think of as. I'm certainly not advocating it. But generally, if you leave a mark, if you remove clothing before you proceed to punish the child, if you use an object, that is frowned upon, and that's going to get you investigated, if not indicated.
We're talking to Kent Dean, who practices in the area of DCFS investigations and appeals, and we're talking about it in light of the horrible case out in Crystal Lake. If you have a call, a question or comment for Kent, please give me a call here at 981-7200. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and continue this conversation. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN. We're talking to attorney Kent Dean, who concentrates his practice in the area of DCFS investigations and appeals. We're talking about in light of this horrible case out in Crystal Lake. It has really impacted a lot of people. I've seen people in tears talking about this and following the case, and with horror and anger now at the parents, and anger in some ways at whatever didn't work in the system to help this young child. Kent, thank you so much for joining us. I have a caller on the line who I'd like to take his call, if you hold for a second. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. So, Kent, can you explain what is a DCFS safety plan and what rights the parents have once such a plan is imposed?
Okay. So, I think Kent dropped off, and we're going to get him on in one second here. Okay, good. Okay, Kent, the question from Dave was, what is a safety plan, and what are the parents' rights when there is a safety plan in place, and how does it work, and how does it get lifted?
Hello?
Hi, Kent.
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear the question?
The safety plans.
Yes.
What can a parent do if a safety plan is requested?
Well, what is a safety plan? When does it come into effect?
Okay. The safety plan is basically, under the Dupuis decision from a few years ago, is basically an investigator thinks they have probable cause, and they think the child may be some risk here, and they don't feel they can completely guarantee the child's safety while they conduct their investigation. They ask for the child, typically either the child to go stay with a grandparent or an aunt or somebody like that, or they ask, as sadly common, father has to be out of the house for a few days while they do the investigation. It is nominally voluntary, but often behind that request for a safety plan is the threat that if you don't go along with this safety plan, we're going to take you to court. Your kid's very likely going to end up in foster care while we sort this out. Again, they must have at least probable cause in order to demand a safety plan. If they don't, then there can be problems there and opportunity for litigation. I'll be blunt.
So the investigation is continued at that point?
Yeah, the safety plan goes on during the investigation, typically. If there's an immediate risk, you think there's an immediate risk. Say, for example, the allegation is domestic violence, and you know, neighbor heard something and called it in. They say, okay, dad has to stay out of the house till we do the investigation. They talk to a couple. A reasonable outcome would be they talk to a couple of people. They talk to mom. They talk to dad. And like, wait a minute, this is confusion. Nothing happened here. Close the safety plan. Continue on with their investigation, but the immediate risk is not present. What often happens, though, is the safety plan gets imposed, and then the investigator is going, well, this case is not so pressing, and then they get distracted, and they have to triage because they simply have so many cases, and they may not come back to this family for many, many, many days. Meanwhile, the child is out of the house, or the dad is out of the house for a long time, and it's rather onerous. Even if the investigation subsequently comes back unfounded, and in other words, they found that there's nothing here, everything's fine, then you still have this period of time where everyone's been separated, and that's very problematic. And
well,
I think that also creates more consumption of the department's resources than is necessary.
Well, and it's traumatic for a child to be taken out of, you know, from the two people he loves the most. Even if these people are not being good to him, it's still traumatic for a child to leave his home and go elsewhere. A couple of the things that I see, I'm just going to give you some facts and tell me how the DCFS looks at them, because we saw the pictures of the house. If you look online, you can Google it and find them. It's just the house was just in a horrible state. There was feces, dog feces, urine. It looked like, I mean, I couldn't even make my house look like that if I tried, and it was just sad. And you see these kinds of cases where there's just this disruption in the household. How does the DCFS treat that in and of itself?
Squalor. We have a term. We call it the dirty house. There's clutter and then there's risk. I saw some of these pictures too. The thing that really struck me was the dog feces.
Yeah.
Dog feces is a real bright line. If you've got animal feces on the floor where the children are exposed to them, you know what? You know, I defend people, but you should be indicated for that. That's ridiculous. That's putting a child at risk. Clutter, like I said, clutter is one thing. I see plenty of people, they come and investigate, you know what, it's just clutter, and they leave people alone. But if the clutter is, say, taller than the child, towers over the child, that's a potential risk of entombment. You know, the stuff could fall on the child. Weak-old dishes, rotting food, those types of things, no plumbing or non-functioning, you know, your water isn't functioning, those are the types of things that are going to get you indicated for what we call the dirty house. environmental neglect.
So let's move to another topic, which is not having the utilities working, because I believe that was the allegation in this case, the Fron case, that there was no electricity and some of the utilities weren't working. Is that in and of itself of concern, unless again, what you're saying is if it impacts the child's safety?
Well, the department is very clearly directed to distinguish between poverty and neglect. And if the problem in the household is simple poverty, then the department is actually obligated to try to help correct that. If the problem is neglect and or, you know, the parents are simply incapable of providing the care, then that falls in the category of dependency. I don't think that's what we had happening here. I mean, you take in the conjunction, you know, the hard drug use, the beyond dirty house, you've got, I'm at a loss. I wish I had a simple explanation as to how this was missed. This child, I don't think this child should have been in this home.
Now, if you look at, like, if I'm going to tick off the things, the kid was born with opiates in his system. The parents had had a history of drug use, and they supposedly went to some sort of therapy, and I don't know how that ended up. The mess, the utilities, there were bruises on the kid's face. The kid said maybe mom, asked me something too loud or whatever. He said there was pretty clear that mom probably hit him. You have the dirty house. You have, you know, what in your opinion and in your experience with the DCFS, and you seems like you've got respect for a lot of these investigators who have a very tough job to do, very tough, and they're overloaded and they're overworked. And this has to really grate on you as a human being to see these kids in these situations. So I'm showing some empathy here, but what happened? What do you think happened? Obviously, you weren't there and you're not in this case, but what do you think happened to make the DCFS turn away and not take action?
You know, there's always the issue of resources. I don't know what kind of caseload this investigator was facing. I don't know. You know, that's always a consideration. That's always in the back of my mind, especially when I'm trying to get what I think to be, you know, this is really unwarranted investigation. Leave these people alone. I just can't seem to get it done. And I know what's going on. They're very busy with other stuff and more pressing cases, such as ones like this.
But you can't predict how
you have all the signs. I don't understand.
But
I really don't understand.
And I guess you can't predict.
It's a trifecta.
Yeah, exactly. But you can't predict. I mean, if you've got a kid who's in filth, that doesn't mean that he's going to be murdered. You know, but the bruises, the bruises to me, you know, are, you know, indicative of this child is not. And again, look, does the DCFS do welfare checks, or when do they do when they close a case that's done?
During a live investigation, they reserve the right to do drop-ins at any hour or any time, and they should. And in a case like this, it sounds like the one they absolutely should have done so.
If you were to say the DCFS needs to change XYZ, just knowing what you know about the organization and how it works, would there be some changes that you would suggest, or is it just that the procedures are in place and we just have imperfect investigations given the facts of the cases?
Well, resources.
Yeah.
I mean, protecting children. Is there any more important role for the government than protecting children? The department has been starved of resources for many, many years. When I started as a public defender working in abuse and neglect in Cook County, Illinois was considered one of the premier states for child welfare in the state of Illinois, and we're now considered in the bottom. That's a 20-year slide. There's this culture of CYA, which we don't need to interpret, but this culture of CYA, which is almost inherent in this type of work, is such that I'm afraid that the department investigators spend a lot of time chasing around really unwarranted cases just to be sure, just to CYA, when there are more pressing cases, such as this young man that we're talking about, that probably warranted more attention.
And you know,
I think the focus is off sometimes. And, of course, the constant turnover in leadership, we've had, 15 directors in 16 years?
Right.
It does not engender any continuity in policy whatsoever. I've seen one initiative after another over the years, you know, rise up, fall away, everyone forgets about it, back and forth. There's been drift for many years. And I know for a fact, and I may argue with these people, but I have people within the department that you know, I have a lot of regard for, and they feel like they're just kind of marching in place, that nothing's getting better, and they, like police, are often blamed for all the social ills that are beyond their control. They're just merely picking up after the fact quite often, which is unfair.
Well, and it makes
so the
morale them
not good.
And it makes them not do their job as well as maybe they could, because morale is so low.
It's terrible.
One of our texters from 630 said the exact same thing. Politicians are quick to criticize, are equally quick to cut the DCFS budget, you know, and where are the foster homes? I suppose that when you don't have enough foster homes, that makes it difficult for a DCFS investigator to say, hey, we can send this child somewhere, but we don't have any place to send her, right?
I don't know if that's really the problem. I think they lack foster homes. They may lack good foster homes at times, but there's plenty of places for kids to go. As I said, the investigations often lay a lot of onerous restrictions and demand a lot of parents right at the beginning, and then they kind of let them drift for a long, long period of time, especially the ones that aren't necessarily at risk. And again, I think that's a big consumption of resources, too.
Kent, I'm going to thank you so much for joining me at the last minute. Kent Dean is an attorney who practices out of Oak Park. His website is kentdeanlaw.com. His number is 708-948-7690. Thank you for joining me, and come on again. And I think this was really helpful for people to understand how this works. Have a good night.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Thanks very much.
All right. Well, this is the time you can ask questions. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been doing it for 33 years. And you can call us here at 312-981-7200 and ask me any legal question you might have. Or like I said, if you have a question about some current event that you have been watching that is of concern to you, or you need something explained, I'll try to do my best to answer it. 312-981-7200. Or you can text to that very same number. I'll give out my phone number at the office. Always do that. Always happy to help people. If it's to refer you to a lawyer or refer you to a website or a social agency, or maybe give you a quick answer or a link to an explanation that will help you be on your way, I'm happy to do that. And that phone number is 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. There was a texter during our segment on the DCFS. Kent Dean did a very good job, I think, of explaining to us how the process works. Someone from, I'm not sure what area code, some people say that the dad, the senior, was an attorney. He was somehow able to manipulate the system. What do you think of that? So I think what our texter is saying is that in this Frond case, the parents, the father of little AJ was an attorney. He was a practicing attorney, apparently, from what I can glean from reading the, basically the things that I've read shows that he met this woman because he was representing her in a divorce. And during the course of the divorce, he did some things along with her, in conjunction with her, that caused him to be sanctioned and caused him to lose his license for a short period of time because he was disposing of assets that belonged to the family, and he wasn't supposed to do that, and he did that in violation of what the judge told him to do. So he got into ethical trouble and he lost his license, and then I'm not sure that he ever re-upped his license. I'm not sure exactly what happened. So the question is, because there was a guy involved here as a father who was an attorney, did he get special treatment? My guess, and I'm only guessing because I don't know what went on between and among the police and the DCFS and these parents, but I would guess that because he's an attorney, he maybe had a little bit of, he was articulate, and he was able to talk his way out of things and explain things. This is why our electricity is turned off, and no, we're not doing drugs, and this house, we're just getting it cleaned up now. Our dog just is not potty trained. I mean, it could be that he was articulate. I don't know that someone would treat a lawyer differently. Maybe. I mean, that's possible. I think it's an interesting fact that someone who is, again, just because someone is intelligent or an attorney doesn't mean that they don't have issues, they don't have drug problems, they're not violent, they're not capable of this kind of thing. I'm just saying, it's interesting that someone could go through 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, very difficult, very expensive, very, very time consuming, and then to let their lives be taken in this way. I mean, to let it devolve into what it devolved into. Again, I'm just probably asserting my own feelings into it. But it's very unfortunate. Again, I don't think he controlled the situation. I think maybe he was just articulate enough to talk his way out of it. So give us a call here. The phone lines are wide open. You'll talk to Ben, my producer, and you'll give him the facts as quickly as you can, and we'll get you on the air. This is Antoinette. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you? Hello, Antoinette. I'm not hearing you. Antoinette. Hi. Ben, is she there? Can you hit the button? I don't know. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Jussie Smollett case. While the calls are coming in, I just want to address this quickly. In this case, we had a interesting thing that happened this week. The interesting thing that happened this week was that a lawyer who is a former judge, Sheila O'Brien, filed a motion to have a special prosecutor appointed to investigate Kim Fox, our current state's attorney, on how she handled the Jussie Smollett case. And it's kind of an unusual thing for a third party who's not related to the case to do it, but the case went in front of the chief judge of the criminal court. His name is Leroy Martin, Jr. And Leroy Martin, if you recognize that name, his father used to be the superintendent of police. Leroy Martin was hearing the motion, and during the course of the argument, Judge O'Brien, we call her judge even though she's no longer a judge, basically said, you might want to recuse yourself, judge, because your son works for the state's attorney's office, and if you do something to reprimand Kim Fox, that would mean that you would be reprimanding your son's boss, and therefore perhaps we need to have somebody else decide this case. Judge Martin apparently was a little miffed by that, and there was a little bit of spatting back and forth. And I've been asked over and over again, and a lawyer, friends of mine have been questioning, what would you do, and is that appropriate, and should she have done that, and what is the judge's, what should the judge do? Again, this is my opinion, but both of these people, the lawyer who brought the motion and Judge Martin, are excellent people. They're excellent lawyers. I have appeared in front of Judge Martin numerous times when he sat on various benches. I think he's fabulous. He's a great, smart guy. He has got a nice temperament. He's a hard worker. He deserves to be where he is. I'm sure he's going to do a good job. I take Sheila O'Brien, a fabulous judge with a reputation that's great. She's well-educated. She's an advocate. She's doing what she thinks is right for no good reason. I mean, she's doing it because she thinks it's right. So this is not for money. This is not for anything that I can see. So the idea that he should recuse himself, it makes some sense. But on the other hand, he's constantly got people in front of him who are from the prosecutor's office. In fact, every case that comes before him has a prosecutor because he does criminal work. So I don't know that he should recuse himself, but I get the argument. The argument is we had lack of transparency with Kim Fox. That is what I think maybe we can all agree on. Looking in, we see that all these charges were brought, then miraculously they were all dropped. The case wasn't even on the court call. They marched into court with a done deal. No one explained it to the police. No one explained it to the public until we asked and begged and demanded an explanation. She still hasn't really explained the whole thing. And we need transparency. So I think what Judge O'Brien is trying to argue is that Leroy Martin, we want to make sure that whatever the result is, that we don't think that there was anything playing favorites. And if that is a concern at all, that he might protect his son by doing something different, I don't think he would do that. I think he's a great judge. I think he can put aside his prejudices. And I think if he found that Kim Fox did something wrong, he would say it and he wouldn't find it. But I understand that she's probably interested in what the public thinks. And what the public thinks here and knows is paramount. And I think the process sort of depends upon that transparency. So I think my opinion is that both parties are doing a good job. Leroy Martin will do a good job. Sheila O'Brien is a great advocate. And hopefully the right thing will happen and we can move on and figure out what really happened. I'm taking your calls. And Antoinette, It was my fault. I had your voice down. So, but I'm going to get to you after the next break. Please give us a call here, 312-981-7200 with your legal questions. Happy Cinco de Mayo to everybody. Happy Derby weekend. Happy Teachers Appreciation Week. I don't know if you say happy Ramadan, but I know Ramadan starts, I think, tonight or tomorrow, 30 days of fasting. So all kinds of things are going on. But give us a call here, 981-7200, 312-981-7200, with any legal questions you might have or questions about current events that you hear and see. Let's go to Dave in Chicago. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to make a point about some of these child abuse cases that go unanswered or they wind up in these tragic ways, is that the kids, what happens is that they're taken to psychiatrists or behavioral experts, they're labeled mentally ill like schizophrenia or hyperactive or ADHD, and what that does, it gets the guardians or the parents off the hook, or at least for the time being. And you know, it's never found out what's really going on in that house because there's doctor-patient confidentiality. But I think this is something that really needs to be looked into.
Dave, I think you're making a really good point. And let's just, again, neither of us is saying, oh, a child who acts up needs to be hurt, I just in case anyone's thinking that. What happens in a lot of cases, now this child was born with opiates in his system, and I don't know about his medical condition, I can't talk about it, but my guess is he's got some issues. When you're born with alcohol in your system or opiates, these children have issues their entire lives. They have problems with impulse control, they have behavioral problems, they have physical problems, they have mental problems with learning to read and learning disabilities and these types of things. Not all the time, but they do. And so what happens is, you know, what you're saying is sometimes the parents, instead of taking them and doing what they need to do with them, they say, well, I had to restrain him, or I had to, use force with him because he was trying to be violent and hurting people. And in fact, I think there was some allegation that the parents said the child had oppositional defiance disorder, which is a diagnosed disorder, personality disorder, that makes children and into adulthood very oppositional. Like you say yes, they say no. Very hard to keep them in classes, hard to keep them disciplined. And again, that doesn't mean you beat your child and you murder your child, but I think you're right that it could be that parents could use that as an excuse as to why the kid had bruises on his body.
Yeah, but I think that personally, from what I know and from what I've seen, I do believe that a lot of kids who are having problems in school, who are labeled with all kinds of psychiatric labels, I think there is something wrong with the parents. I really do. I don't believe in this idea of chemical imbalances or genetic predispositions. There really is something wrong with these parents. They are very narcissistic. They relate to their kids as though they were objects. They should not bring children into the world. I think it happens more than often than we realize.
And Dave, you know, I probably disagree with you because, I mean, I know so many parents are friends of mine and clients of mine, and the child just, you know, needs help in some way. And you see that one of the children is a perfect A student, you know, complying with everything perfectly, no learning problems at all, and the other child can't sit still, can't learn, is disruptive, and you say, why? Why is this happening? I don't know.
There might be a favored child with the parent, and the other child may be resented by the parents. You know, family systems can get pretty pathological sometimes.
Well,
it may look okay on the outside, but what goes on in the inside, it can be really complicated.
I think the whole thing is complicated, but I think in my situation, I probably defer to the professionals, because far be it for me to say that, you know, if a parent changed his parenting, that child would not have dyslexia. I can't say that could possibly happen. But thanks for the call, Dave. I really appreciate it. I think it's a good
viewpoint
to get all our good viewpoints here. Let's go to Jim on the North Side. Welcome to WGN.
Yes, how you doing, Karen?
Good, Jim.
I have a question concerning a GAL or guardian ad litem.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't seem like he has that much skin in the game, as I should put it. So everything just keeps going into court appearances or status. So as he shows up, there is no status. So he will bill $300 just for showing up, and nothing is getting resolved until therapy is going on.
Jim, can I just...
Yes.
I want to first educate my listeners who don't really understand what you're talking about so that they can follow along. So you're going
sure.
through a divorce, or you have a case regarding parenting issues, correct?
Correct, yes.
And the court appoints a guardian ad litem, who is an attorney who has some training, not a lot necessarily, who is supposed to be advising the court, a friend of the court, to advise about the child. So the parents are fighting with their lawyers, but the guardian is supposed to be the neutral person who's reporting to the judge as to what should be done for this child in their best interests. And what you're telling me, and I work in the system and I know this, there are some good GALs who really do their job, and there's some of them who don't. And you're right. If there's no status, they go to court and they say, oh, I didn't get around to seeing the children and talk to them. Hey, let's just kick it over for another month. Meanwhile, all the attorneys have gone to court. Thousands of dollars have been spent, and your child still hasn't been spoken to. So is that your situation?
Basically, we had spoken to the GAL, but he has deferred it to a therapist. So the ex-wife is making it hard for me to go to the therapist, and everything just gets kicked back, like you say, to a status. Status on what? And I will email him and go, why are you going to come to court? There is no status because nothing's going on. I don't have access to my daughter.
Right.
You know? And then he will send me a bill. I even send him emails almost laying out a perfectly cut case of facts. You know, it's emails of facts, you know, so he can go into court with facts, not just my interpretation of things. They're actual facts, times, dates, this, that. So he will read that, and then he will send me a bill. I send
but
him
do nothing,
email.
But do nothing on it. So let me just give you my quick answer without knowing all
sure.
the facts. I see this all the time. I feel your pain.
Right.
I don't like dealing with some GALs for that very reason, where I feel like my client is being billed because of their delays, and meanwhile, the children
right.
are suffering because they might have issues, and we're not
right.
resolving them, and we're not moving this forward, and we're not getting closure on the case, and the only people who are benefiting are you know, your lawyers, but I don't, you know, personally, I don't
right.
like benefiting on someone else's misery, but I think what you need to do is have your lawyer make the contact. I know that's involving another person, but I think you should be sending these things, and I think that your lawyer should be stepping up and saying, we gave the GAL all this information. We should have had this done. Judge, we need to move this along. This is costing the parties too much money. We don't have a resolution, and your lawyer should be the one to step up in court, and judge might reprimand the GAL and say, you know, Mr. Smith, you must move this along, because the judges will appoint the GAL in other cases, and if the GAL is not doing a good job, then that GAL might say, oh, he's not going to give me any more work. I better get on the stick and do something. So that's best advice to you.
Oh, okay. As just a quick caveat, if I can dispute this, you know what I mean, I have a right to dispute his charges, correct?
You do.
I mean,
you know. Do at the end. You do at the end. You have a right to put him on the stand and cross-examine him on whether or not he did his job. But I'm going to have to jump off. But thank you for the
no
call.
No problem. Thank you,
and
Karen.
I wish you luck on that, because that's a real tough one. And Terry, I think you were the one who had the question that I couldn't get to.
Oh, yes. Thanks very much, Karen.
Sure.
Appreciate it. I just wanted to find out, can you tell me basically what is the difference between a revocable and an irrevocable trust? I'm thinking of redoing my standard will to make it a trust.
Good. So it doesn't have to go through probate and maybe avoid some other issues. I can't give you specific advice on whether you should do that, because it depends on the size of your estate, and I'm not a
mm-hmm.
practitioner in this area. But the simple difference between
okay.
a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust is that
mm-hmm.
with a revocable trust, you don't move your assets into the trust. So your house and everything and your bank accounts, they all remain outside the trust. Irrevocable trust is the first thing you do after you sign on the dotted line. You put all of your assets, you transfer. Think of the trust as being a barrel, and you take all of your stuff and you put it in the barrel. So you title your bank accounts, you title your house, you title every single asset you own in the name of the trust. And the reason that you would do this, there are varied reasons. You can get tax benefits. It protects your assets in some ways. It makes it easier to transfer those assets once you pass. And there's other reasons that you might want to do it. So this is something where you need to sit down with a lawyer who does this estate planning. And if anyone needs an estate planner, I've got several that I refer people to, some of them in the city, some of them in the suburbs. But you will ask that specific question to your lawyer. But that's generally the answer. Okay?
Okay. So, all right.
All right,
Terry.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. Have a nice night. We'll continue to take your legal calls. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. It's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Time for legal calls. I'm taking them as fast as I can. 312-981-7200. Do you have legal questions about anything? I will try to answer them the very best I can. 708 texter says, "Hi, Karen. I am proud to be an oncology nurse, and it is Oncology Nursing Month along with National Nurses Week as well. I didn't know that. I was wishing everyone a happy Cinco de Mayo and Teachers Appreciation Week, but a happy Oncology Nurse and National Nurses Week to all of those people. They do such great jobs. Has anyone been in the hospital lately? These people do such a good job. A lot of very nice, kind people with good attitudes, and it can make all the difference in the world, and I thank you all. Same with the teachers. I'm taking your legal questions here, 981-7200, and I have a few from the text, and I have a few from this week, which I keep track of, and I read them. I change people's names, so whenever you call me, it's obviously very confidential. I've got a 773 texter who says, "A judge ruling in a divorce case that went to trial allocated some of my wife's legal fees to me, and I have to pay them in 45 days. I don't have resources to pay them. Between child support and maintenance, I'm living check to check. The GAL involved suggested I come up with the money, otherwise the judge will put me in jail. I just don't have money or savings. Divorce made me broke. What will happen to me if I don't meet the deadline?" Unfortunate. You know, I see this all the time. And what happens in a divorce, just to educate everybody, is if there's a rule called the level playing field rule. That's what we call it. Which means that during the course of a divorce, because we don't want one party having all of the assets and all of the resources, and so let's just say the husband maybe is working and the mother is at home with children and she doesn't have access to bank accounts, the judge will allocate, meaning give the wife some money. Well, it's her money too. I mean, all of the money that you earn during the course of the marriage belongs to both parties. It doesn't matter who earns it. And a lot of people lose track of that. So if there's a pool of money, a savings account or the like, it's very common for the judge to say, all right, wife takes part of it and husband takes part of it. In this case, this is after the divorce was finalized. The case went to trial, so I imagine that the fees are very extensive, which happens when you try a case. And he is saying that he can't pay them. Well, the judge should have made a finding that you can pay them. And, you know, if you have a 401k, I know that you don't want to liquidate that because there are penalties and interest, but the judge may be saying to you, sir, that's what you're going to do, that you're more able to afford the legal fees than the wife. It's a bad situation. I can't tell you not to honor the court order, because if it's a court order, the judge is going to have some ramifications. I suggest that what you do is perhaps have your lawyer draft a petition to extend the time and put you on a payment schedule. And you're going to have to show the judge your bank accounts and say, I don't have any money sitting here. I don't have a 401k. I don't have enough money to pay out of my paycheck between the payment for the maintenance and child support and all the expenses for the children and my own living expenses. I don't have an extra dollar to do that. So I need to be put on some kind of payment schedule, or perhaps you need to go out and take a loan out. But generally, the judges should have made some sort of finding that you are able to pay. It's about the best advice I could give you. Tell you, divorce, I practice in this area. And going to trial is so expensive. If there's any possibility at all of mediating or doing a divorce in a collaborative manner, there's a thing called a collaborative divorce. It just is such a better way to do it. Now, this is not always possible when you have somebody, maybe your spouse is angry and your spouse doesn't want to settle and your spouse is not being reasonable and there's no way you could settle because you can't sit down and talk civilly. You really need to try that as much as you can, because as much as, you know, lawyers, you know, this is what we're trained to do. We try cases, and I like trying cases, but I really like settling cases because at least it's over. And the family can go back to trying to be normal at all, if that's possible. The friction is gone, and you at least have some control over what you've gotten, as opposed to waiting for a judge who doesn't know you, doesn't know your family, doesn't know your children, doesn't know your assets like you do, making a decision that might not sit right with you in the long run. But good luck to you on that. I want to ask, there was a Carol from Downers Grove sent me a text a couple weeks ago. She needed a cancer treatment, and she named it that her insurance company deemed to be experimental, and she really wanted to get it. It was quite expensive, and her position is that the treatment that we're talking about is not experimental, in that many different doctors are recommending it, many people are getting it, it's been proven to be effective. She asked what she can do, and generally speaking, when an insurance company denies your claim, you've got to go to the policy as quickly as you can and make sure you comply with the appeals procedure, because there's usually an appeals procedure in writing that tells you what you need to do if you disagree. And normally there's one appeal and maybe sometimes two appeals, and then you have a right to bring it to the court. And these are hard cases to win and very expensive cases to win. And usually you'd rather spend your money on the treatment rather than spending it on an attorney with the chance that you might win, which is unfortunate, because that puts you in a really bad bind and it puts you in a disadvantage with the insurance companies. But usually the first appeal is a written appeal where maybe you submit the medical records and your doctor's recommendations and whatever it is that is necessary to show the insurance company that this is not experimental and that it's necessary for your health. Sometimes I put in the appeal that this would save money in the long run, because perhaps this treatment would be curative enough that it would avoid you having to have further surgeries or operations or treatments in the future. So hopefully the insurance company would see that this would be something cost effective rather than something that would cost them more, because insurance companies are all about the money. They don't really care about you. They care about the money. They care about keeping their money. And that's just the way it is. But good luck to you, Carol. I hope that works out. I had a texter, Sandy, from Forest Park, who says, I'm having my kitchen remodeled. The contractor wants half of the money up front. Do I have any choice? It's a lot of money. And what if he doesn't do the work? Well, I'm glad you're asking that question, because I see it on the other side when people email me or call me and say, oh my gosh, I gave all the money up front. The guy took it. He never showed up, or he showed up one day and I haven't seen him in 2 months and I don't know where he is and I don't even know if he's licensed and I'm out all this money. And a lot of people have gone with maybe the lowest bidder or somebody who's going in the neighborhood and saying, I can fix your roof. And these people are scam artists, or maybe they just get caught up on something else and they just decided that it doesn't matter. And if you sue them, it's not going to matter anyway. Very, very unfortunate. But I would say that make sure you can negotiate with your contractor. Why don't you say, let me give you one third up front? And as far as materials, so for instance, if you have an expensive set of windows or doors that you're installing, why give you the money for him to buy it? You should go and put the money down at Lowe's or whatever it is, or give the credit card to Lowe's and buy it. So that, and obviously I'm not saying you pick it up, I'm saying you buy it so he can't take your money and run with it. So at least you bought those doors. So if nothing else, you're not going to lose that money. Then put your one third down and say to the contractor, when you're done with half of it, you know, I'll give you another third. And then when I'm finally satisfied with the entire project, then I'll give you the final third. And I think that's a good way to do it. And hopefully, you know, if you don't like the way he's acting when you're making these demands and these requests, then I think you should maybe look for another contractor and see if you can get somebody who would agree to the terms that you're comfortable with, because you are very right to be worried about this and be concerned about it. Let's see. I'm in the middle of a divorce. My aunt passed away a few years ago. My inheritance is basically letting my husband off the hook. The judge said the maintenance is temporary. I'm in house with kids. I have to pay all the household bills. He's living with a family member. He's working full time, and I raised the kids and gone back to work part time. What are the chances of maintenance continuing? Well, you're not obligated to use your inheritance to live off of. That's not the way is supposed to be. But maintenance now is statutory, which means that there is a law that sets forth what your maintenance is. And maintenance is spousal support. It used to be called alimony, for those of you who don't know, separate and apart from child support. And there's temporary maintenance, which the judge is saying is on a temporary basis. But given the length of your marriage, you might be entitled to additional years of maintenance. And again, the statute, the law, will set forth how many years of marriage equals how many months of maintenance. And if you look at that statute, you will know how much maintenance you will get, because the judge will very likely award you maintenance based upon that statute. Very often, not very often, do they deviate. Your inheritance should not come into play. I mean, you have that as a backdrop. You shouldn't be using that kind of money. That should be your retirement money. That's your go-to money when you need it. But if you're working, if you've gone back to work after having children, then the court's going to consider that, because they're going to consider that you're making income, and your income is going to be set off in part by what you're making. The maintenance that he pays is based on a certain percentage that he makes and a certain percentage that you make. So it's a math formula, as your lawyer probably described to you. So if you're working, it may be, if you're making as much money as he is, I don't know if you are, it may be that you're not entitled to maintenance because you're maintaining yourself. And then you would only be entitled to child support. So without any more facts, that's the best I can give you. Why don't we take some more legal questions? But I'd also like to get the third caller. We're going to do a little Cinco de Mayo quiz here and the Karen Conti Show. We're going to ask some questions about Mexico. And if you get a certain number right, you'll win a very valuable prize. And give us a call here at 981-7200, 981-7200, or give me a text at that very same number. It's Karen Conti Show on WGN. Make you just want to, I don't know, eat some guacamole, have a margarita, put on a sombrero. I love Mexico. Jerry and I go there all the time. I love all parts of Mexico. I like the resort places. I like the little towns. I like Mexico City. It's a great big city. It's a fabulous city. Does anyone want to play my Mexican quiz? I don't think so, because I don't see anyone calling. Valuable prizes are at stake here. 312-981-7200. Ben is ready to take your call and get you on the air to do a Mexican quiz. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to know anything about anything. You can just be a good guesser, okay? Being a good guesser can get you very far in life, I think. And I think maybe we have someone who wants to play. Is that right? And, you know, if not, Jerry's going to have to play. And I don't know. Jerry, are you up to it today?
Tequila.
Tequila. who wants to play? Okay, here we go. Okay, Jerry, but you can kind of add your 2 cents and or your 2 pesos, I might say. And Roger, you can.
Si, señorita, cómo está?
That's really good. You need to take some remedial Spanish.
I need to take some remedial everything.
Okay, here we go. All right, now we're going to get our contestant on the line who has the best name in the world, Karen from Kankakee.
Yay.
Now, do you feel an echo?
Why? I just kind of do.
How do I get rid of the echo? Is your radio on?
No, it is off.
Okay.
I'm not hearing it now.
Oh, is it better now?
Yeah.
So we can we
well, sometimes we get an echo with some calls. It just happens. Oh, I love this effect.
Hello, hola. Is there something we can do about this? Karen, can you call us back?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Try to call us back. See if we can do that. Because that's just going to drive me crazy. Jerry, what's your favorite place in Mexico? Of all the places we've traveled?
The city of Guanajuato, the state of Guanajuato. And there's another city in Guanajuato called San Miguel de Allende. It's up in the mountains, about 6,300 feet up. So you can go there and it's not sweltering hot. In the summer, you can actually buy property there. Most people think you can't buy property in Mexico. You can only lease it if it's on the ocean. But otherwise, you can buy a home in Guanajuato.
I have to say, we spent a lot of time going to the various places like Puerto Vallarta, which I always say, if you can't have fun in Puerto Vallarta, something is seriously wrong with you because it has the best food. It's just wonderful. It's fun. It's safe. I do like San Miguel de Allende. It's a picture, a little town, just scenic, and it's traditional. So you don't feel like, you're in Cancun. Cancun is fun, too. I'm not saying it's not fun, but in Cancun, I kind of feel like I'm in the United States because everything's in English. There, it's very traditional. And like you say, the weather is great and the food is fabulous and it's a walking city and it's safe and it's really good. I agree with you on that. Let's try Karen again. Karen, is the echo gone?
I hope it is.
Oh, here we go. You're out of the cave. Here we go. All right. We have like 7 questions, and we're going to move through these very quickly. And I say if you get 3, then you're going to win the valuable prize, which is yet to be determined. Ready?
Okay,
This is a true or false question. The Yucatan, the word Yucatan, like as in the Yucatan Peninsula, was named after a misunderstanding. True or false?
True.
It is true. When the Spaniards arrived, they asked what the place was called, and the locals answered Yucatan, which meant, in the local language, I don't understand you. So the Spaniards thought they had replied with the name of the place, so therefore it is called Yucatan. Very good. I know you knew that, right? I know you knew that. All right, number 2, what is the name of the Mexican celebration that occurs at the end of October that honors those who have passed on? Do you know the name of that?
Dia de los Muertos.
Dia de los Muertos. Oh, I think we have a Spanish speaker here. This traditional celebration, which I find to be wonderful. You're honoring the dead. You're celebrating them. And by the end of the celebration, it's time to mourn and remember the dead and to celebrate and honor them. I think it's a fabulous holiday, and all the little scary skeletons are very cute. All right.
As do I. I celebrate it with my students.
Yeah, it's great. We should be doing something like that here. Considered one of the wonders of the world, I'm going to ask you, in Mexico, A, the Mayan ruins of Guadalajara, B, the waterfalls of Guanajuato, C, the pyramid of Chichen Itza, or the largest sombrero in the world in Mexico City?
I would have to say Chichen Itza.
That is true, because the other ones are completely and totally false. No waterfalls in Guanajuato. The pyramid was once part of the Mayan Empire, and it was named as one of the 7 wonders of the world in 2007. It's one of the most visited archaeological sites in Mexico, with over 2.6 million tourists in 2017. Okay. True or false, Mexico is the largest Spanish-speaking country in the world?
I'll say true.
It is true. There are more people speaking Spanish as their first language than in Spain or any country in South America. Very good. You already won, but we're going to continue. Mexico is the largest exporter of car parts, silver products, tortillas, or beer.
I would say car parts.
It is not. There were 2 that you could have chosen, and silver products was 1.
Silver.
And interestingly, beer is the biggest exporter of beer in the world. Isn't that interesting? True or false, the Aztecs sacrificed 1% of their population each year.
I'm going to say true.
That is true. It was considered an important part of the everyday life to appease and honor the gods. That would have equaled 250,000 people a year. Very, very interesting. All right.
Wow.
How many taxis are there in Mexico City? 10,000? 50,000? 0, because they're all Uber drivers, or D, 100,000?
Oh, 50,000.
100,000 cab drivers in Mexico City. It's one of the largest cities in the world, but it's still a huge amount of taxis. All right. Mexico is sinking every year. We know that. By how much? As much as 2 inches a year? As much as 4 inches a year? as much as a foot a year or as much as 3 feet every year?
The whole country?
It varies. It varies. The sinking varies.
This is an average.
Yeah, this is sort of like as much as, the most that it sinks.
4 inches?
You know what? It's as much as 3 feet.
Wow.
In the last 60 years, the city has sunk more than 32 feet. The reason is the large demand for water, which is being taken from an aquifer, which is below the city. Some of the buildings are leaning, and it's causing problems. One last question. You're doing muy bien. The following questions. One is false. A, Caesar salad was invented in Mexico. B, chocolate originally comes from Mexico. C, artists can pay their taxes using artwork they create. Or D, Cinco de Mayo is a national holiday. Which is false?
Cinco de Mayo.
That is true. Cinco de Mayo is not a national holiday in Mexico, but Caesar salad was invented in Mexico. Chocolate does come from Mexico, and artists can pay their taxes using their artwork. You have done a great job, Karen. Muy bien. And we'll be sending you a regalo muy, what do you say? How do you say it?
Especial.
What is especial? Especial. Inmediatamente. ¿Está bien?
Excelente. Gracias.
Ah, de nada. Tengo un buen noche.
Y usted.
All right. Thanks, Karen. Thanks for playing the game. Take care. All right.
Thank you.